Thanks, Bob. Having said all that, I realize that the only reason you're listening to me is because I'm from more than 50 miles away. And research, I think, proves that beyond a shadow of a doubt. And I also want you to know, particularly those of you who listened so patiently this morning, while I did my best to confuse you so you would go home and do some study of your own and not take my word for it above all things, that I am well aware of the research regarding the length of time in which an audience can pay attention to a speaker. Are you familiar with that research? You may be interested in it. It was done at San Diego State by a person trying to get their master's degree, and I've always kind of admired that university for giving this person the degree, because what he found was that for the first 10 minutes, almost any audience will pay attention to almost any speaker just out of simple politeness. During the second 10 minutes, well, it's kind of iffy, it's kind of 50-50, people pay attention and then they drift away. But after 20 minutes, it's unanimous. Everybody is into sexual fantasizing. So if the person next to you is nodding off, you'll have some idea what's going on, right? How did we ever feel that public relations could get along without research? Pre-testing, research of publics and messages, and all of those things, evaluation research. It's kind of interesting to me that we ever thought, here we are kind of strolling along like babes in the woods, totally unaware that there's a wolf behind the third tree. So to me, research is really a wolf detector. It tells me where the wolves are and where they're apt to get at me. I think that's important. However, I think it's equally important that we know that if the wolf is 30 trees down, and we're going to turn left at the 23rd tree, that we don't worry about it. So the question is, how can we get here and now information, right here, right now, rather than beautiful then and there kind of stuff, which may never occur? Much of the research that we do, I would suggest to you, is then and there. It's way out there, somewhere else, some other time. So I want to try, in the few minutes we have now, to really bring this down to here and now. I want to make three postulations. Remember, my general thesis is that our first responsibility is to convince our fellow managers that public relationships are the key to running an effective organization. This isn't something nice and touchy-feely that we do if we have the time or if we can, but that in fact, if you look at American society, public relationships are what influence indeed decide on our social mores, our political decisions, and our economic decisions. Those decisions are not based on facts. They're based on relationships people have one with another, with organizations, with institutions, and with the flow of perceptions within those organizations. That's how society really functions. Don't believe me. Read any book on political science, any book on management, and I should probably stop right here and thank all those wonderful authors of management books in the last few years for putting it over on people to claim they were management books. Because if you've read any of them, whether it was the One Minute Manager, whether it was the Excellence books, you recognized them, didn't you, as public relations books, because that's really what they were. Well, if that's the kind of world we live in, and you can check political science, management, sociology, psychology, then there's got to be ways for us to demonstrate that we have the capabilities, that we have the information and the talents to help organizations deal with this very real world where public relationships set the environment. So I want to approach this from three different ways. Before I do that, though, several of you have asked me, what did I mean this morning when I said that reacting to an attack, let's just use the word attack, and you can substitute softer words if that's your situation. What do I mean that reacting to that is usually a suicidal course? Because people say, yeah, but my CEO says they're not going to get away with that, or we're going to get the facts out, or answer those guys. Well, what I mean in a relationship to research is that most first-time questionings of an organization are heard by precious few people. Let me give you an example. In Toronto, Canada, the Globe and Mail is sort of the combination of New York Times and Wall Street Journal of that country. So if media were at all powerful, it would be powerful, okay? One morning, totally without warning, the headline in big boxcar type was Royal Bank Rips Off Mortgage Holders. Oh, the Royal Bank is just another commercial bank. You know, it's Canada. Don't worry about it. It isn't the government or the Queen or anything. That's just the name of the bank. Well, the Royal Bank chairman came to work and he read that. And needless to say, he was right in the vice president for PR's office saying, you know, give it to them, get the facts out there. Well, fortunately, this person is a professional. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. That would be stupid. Let's wait and see what kind of penetration this has had. So, you know, with a couple of straitjackets and three armed posses, he was able to keep the CEO in his office that day. He didn't call the media. He didn't respond. And at night, 5 o'clock, remember now, this was headlines in the G&M. That means that all the little newspaper dispenser boxes, there it was, showing through the glass, was on the noon news, on the broadcast media. It was on the afternoon continuing shows that cut in every once in a while for news. At 5 o'clock that day, they did a cross-Toronto study. They got people going home at the subway stations and in automobile routes, and then they went into the homes by telephone. 5% of Torontans knew that the claim had been made. 5%. Supposing that that research hadn't been done and that the PR vice president had said, yes, sir, and responded, how many people do you think would have known about it by, if not 5 o'clock that day, 5 o'clock the next day? Because when they did the study the next day, the number was down to 3%. And you may ask why? Well, the G&M had another headline that morning, right? Which had replaced the Royal Bank in the passing parade. The evidence is overwhelming that when we respond to critics, the primary thing we do is legitimize the criticism. Remember basic psychology. The mind can only deal first with positive concepts. The Royal Bank is ripping off mortgage holders. Then it plugs in the negative, not. So whenever you make that kind of a statement psychologically, what you're making is the critical statement all over again. People say, yeah, but my CEO. Okay, if your CEO doesn't understand that, let me ask you a question. Who should be teaching the CEO the realities? You know, we're supposed to be the great persuaders. Maybe our first audience is closer to home than out there somewhere. The reason CEOs feel they have to respond is known in research circles as the third-party effect. Here's how it goes. The CEO follows public comment through the media, politicians, and others, right? Actually, we know how he gets all that stuff. We clip it out and listen, and we bring it to him in the morning in a report, or somebody like us does. So he's following what's going on. Now, the circle in which he or she travels is made up of similar people who are following it. So when your CEO goes to the club and she says to some fellow CEOs, did you see that thing in the paper? They say, boy, I sure did. They gave it to you good. And she says, oh, my God, everybody has heard. Because, I mean, aren't CEOs average people like everybody else? And so that third-party effects keeps them thinking that everybody has seen it. Now, let's assume, very conservatively, that the Royal Bank was right. Only 5% of Torontans, which after all comprises their customers for mortgages, had heard about it, and therefore their attitudes had in any way been polluted. First, you have to look at the subject of mortgages. Did this mean people were going to switch to another bank? Were mortgage holders going to run in and cash in their Royal Bank mortgage? Gotten a mortgage lately? You know, it's 6 months and closing costs later. So what was the chance of behavior on that Zippo? Were people who were then thinking of applying for a mortgage going to go somewhere else? Possibly. But remember now, we're talking about 5% of the public. What possible damage then was done by the study? Ah, some opinion leaders, some third-party effect folks probably saw it because they follow the media. What then is the proper response of the Royal Bank? Exactly what they did. They ignored the G&M, and so the story died. And instead, they went to the opinion leaders in those circles apt to have been polluted by this misinformation. Story wasn't true, as it turned out. And they dealt directly one-on-one with the opinion leaders. To go back through the media would have been to empower those folks once again to be the gatekeepers, to tell just what they wanted to tell and to leave out what they didn't want to put in, and to spread the infection all over the place. But don't take my word for it. I gave several examples this morning of the truth. Let me give you one more. A client of ours, I may have mentioned, has the dubious distinction of building the world's largest nuclear power plant. A few of the folks in their state are a bit apprehensive about this, particularly right now. But the apprehension has been primarily on what it's going to do to rates. A rate rise is a big question, and all the politicians are milking it for all they're worth. For about a year and a half, the word has been out, and it's been used repeatedly in political speeches and in the media, that electric rates are going to go up 55% as soon as this plant is online. And there's evidence from other parts of the country that this could happen. So it's not just someone's dream. Okay, the chairman, you know, one morning it finally got under his skin and he was determined to go on an all-out campaign to say our rates will not rise 55%. Great message strategy. But no, we said, wait a minute, let's do some research. Let's find out what people think really and what they know, and then what the attitudes are behind what they know, and then will any behaviors result from all of this, or is it just a passing parade? Just information being exchanged which will affect nothing. Here's what we found out. 78% of all the people in this state were convinced that rates would rise. Why? Doesn't everything go up? That was the answer. Doesn't everything go up? Then when you asked them, only about 2% even mentioned the nuke coming online. And then we said, well, have you heard any numbers about how much rates might rise? Most of them said, well, I don't know, what's inflation? Because see, we've all been brainwashed that everything goes up to keep up with inflation. So I don't know, what's inflation? What's cost of living? Those were the kind of phrases we got. Some people said, well, the nuke out there is going to do it. About 18% said, yeah, the nuke will raise the rates. And so we said, well, how much do you think they'll go up? Oh, I don't know, 10%, 15%. Finally, we said, well, have you heard any really, you know, big numbers, like 55%? 4% of the public had heard that they might go up 55%. Okay? And this utility now was going to go on an all-out million-dollar campaign to say our rates will not go up 55%. If they had done that, and then I did the study, what do you think the findings would have been? One more example. I just want to make sure you understand this. If you're not familiar with diffusion process, by the way, if you're not totally familiar with how people really make decisions and react to information, give me your business card and I'll send you a piece on diffusion. I hope you're all very familiar with it. It's the basic behavioral science underpinning of all public relations, all marketing, really of all social interactions in our society. Remember when LBJ was president? A critic of LBJ's wrote a book called Some Dare Call It Treason. Was kind of a Reaganite concept in a Johnsonian era. LBJ quickly put the word out to the government. No one who likes working here will mention the book or will respond to any mention of same. Result? Very poor sales, minor circulation among far-right groups who love the idea. End of story. I live in New Hampshire, where we have a wonderfully famous newspaper called the Manchester Union Leader, and Bill Loeb, you may have heard of it. I've been on their blacklist for 22 years. They have a blacklist, people they won't mention. So if I do something, it'll say the garden party was attended by Susie Smith, Tom Jones, and a public relations consultant from Exeter. That's me. They can't use my name. It's against the rule. Every politician up there has kowtowed to the union leader since time immemorial, which means what? The union leader is running the state, not the politician. Because they set the agenda, they twist it around. But we had the most effective governor in history. So effective that during the Eisenhower administration, everybody said he was running the government and they ran a little campaign to get him out, a guy named Sherm Adams. When people would come to Sherm and they'd say, what do you think about that piece in the Union Leader? He'd say, I think I've heard of that newspaper. Where do they publish it? Or they'd say, how about that piece this morning in the UL? And he'd say, I never heard of that. I never heard of that outfit. Who runs that? He just kidded it right out of existence and was able to get through all of his program, which was exactly the opposite of what the union leader stood for, because he refused to recognize the existence of this power. Final example. Contrast what LBJ did with what the Roman Catholic Church is now busy doing. And that's interesting because the Roman Catholic Church has, by my standards, the most sophisticated public relations operation in America. General Motors goes to Rush Shaw, the head of the bishop's operation, to learn new techniques. They have two satellites, not one, two satellites up there bouncing it off, and one of the two collections that's nationwide in the church every year is for public relations. The other is for the needy overseas. Tell you something to remember also, They've got God on their side, and they still need public relations, okay? Now, a little movie comes out from France called Hail Mary. I don't know if it's been here. I don't know if you've seen it. Well, the bishops never saw it, but someone told them that it was really doing things to their beliefs. So they launched this campaign, stay away, and all the people are picketing, and the theater owner said, thank God, revenues have been down. This will bail us out. I went to see it. It was a kind of a movie. I wouldn't have gone otherwise. But, you know, there was a line. You had to wait 3 showings to get in, and all these pickets. Gang, can't we catch on and stop shooting from the hip and start doing some research to find out what's really happening? Remember the doctors? Don't you want the doc, when you go in, to give you a real diagnosis and find out, you know, should he cut the toe off because it kind of looks like it ought to come off? Or would you rather have him find out for sure whether it has to be cut off? Personally, I am in the latter school, and I would hope that we can start using our research so that we can all get into that school. I want to do 3 things quick, having, I hope, confused you even further on that point, or at least made you think about it. That's the principle of cognitive dissonance, I hope. There are 8 ways that we can prove through accountants-type analysis that public relations affects the bottom line of our organizations, of any organization. Got rid of those guys fast, didn't I? Let me just share those with you, and then you tell me what role research has in each of them, or if it has a role, or if it's important in public relations. I'm talking now about things. In doing this study, we actually had accountants look at costs of the operation of organizations so that an auditor could stand up and say, yes, this would have an impact on the bottom line. I mean, I'm talking now about hard-nosed behavioral evaluation. The first way that public relations affects the bottom line is with awareness, publicity, promotion, all that stuff we do so well and which, in my view, has been overdone by us. We concentrate on that too much and not enough on other stuff. I don't have to tell you about that. If we've got a new product and we let people know about it, we know that's very positive. They're apt to buy the product and it affects the bottom line. Don't think I need to say any more about that. How about motivation? Who was given the assignment of motivating the people inside the organization to use teamwork, productivity, speak with one clear voice, and all of that kind of stuff? We are. Does that affect the bottom line? Well, I don't know. For 10 years in this country, we've been told by everybody that productivity is the be-all and end-all, and we're essentially responsible for it. Now, engineers keep saying, oh, well, it's the new machinery. That'll make us more productive. Oh, they don't understand human nature. No machine has ever been built that a human couldn't screw up in 10 seconds or less. And our ingenuity at how to screw them up is just knows no bounds. Productivity is a function of the human environment over everything, as we are finding out when we finally plug in QWL programs, task teams, quality circles. If you don't believe it, the Japanese now measure 0 defects in millionths. Millionths. It works. And that's in our portfolio. And it affects the bottom line like mad. Early warning system. Issue anticipation, if you want to call it that. No surprises, if you want to use Harold Janine's phrase. If public relations people are, as we discovered in a 1980 study, the folks in the middle, the ones who have to be inside the organization and contribute to its policies and then get those interpreted outside, and then go outside and learn about what's going on out there and get that interpreted inside, so that an effective public relations person is one where the boss says, whose side are you on anyway? That's an effective public relations person. If we're in this listening post, this ambassadorial position in the middle, wow, what an opportunity to feed back in the early warnings. Do they affect the bottom line? Well, I don't know. Have you had a crisis in your organization lately? Did it deflect anybody from doing their job? Did it take management's mind off excellence and productivity and achieving the goals? You know it did, and you know that costs bucks. The flip side of that is that we can affect the bottom line by learning about new opportunities, and we do it in the same way because we're the people in the middle. And it may be something just as simple as putting on an open house on the south side of town for a new service that the hospital is going to offer, and having somebody who's visiting come in and say, hey, I live on the east side. Why don't you offer it over there? Could be as simple as that, and it could be far more sophisticated. But we are in a wonderful position, probably better than anybody else. Remember, except for the payroll clerk, which is the most important person in every organization, except for that person, our department is usually the only one that deals with everybody, everybody. Other departments have limited scope. We deal with everybody, so we're in the best position to see this. And then that wonderful fifth method, removing executive isolation. Wow, does that ever affect the bottom line? Because executives, particularly the senior executives, you know, can screw things up worse and cost more than the rest of us. And what's the problem with all managers today? They're so busy, they're so inundated, that it's hard not to get isolated. Who's supposed to keep them from getting isolated? Well, I don't know, why do we do those clipping things and give them to them in the morning? But are we giving them more? Are we doing our issues anticipation research so that in addition to telling them what's in the local paper, we're also telling them that some arcane journal out of Salem, Oregon has an article on a subject that, should it get around, would have impact on us? I hope we are. It's a research function. There are some more. How about, I'll use this word, I hate it. How about image protection? Sometimes you just cannot avoid a crisis. You just can't. It's a Tylenol situation where you had nothing to do about it. During that period, what happens to organizations? Well, I've already discussed that. They go to hell because everybody is scurrying around dealing with the crisis. Furthermore, our trusting publics tend to kind of wonder about us, if we have any trusting publics. Many organizations don't. They just live by daily consent. And as soon as anybody criticizes them, the whole public says, I knew it, those bastards. Okay? Who during that period can keep the organization functioning, can cheerlead it, pull it back, emphasize its good points in the face of attack? Well, you know what Larry Burke said, the president of, Jim Burke, the president of Tylenol, he says, you know, when I got the word, I came in, he said, called all the senior officers together, and I looked around the table, and I said, there's my sales vice president, fat help he is. There's my lawyer, forget that. There's my accountant, oh my God. He went around the table and finally came to Larry Foster, the vice president of public relations. He said, all the rest of you go home. There's only one guy in this company that can help now, and that's my vice president of public relations. That's what I'm talking about right here. Did it save Johnson & Johnson any money? No, it cost them $100 million right off, but they're in business now after two scares with a larger share of market than they had the first time. Supposing they had replied the way maybe Hooker Chemical did at Love Canal, or the way General Public Utilities did at Three Mile Island, or the way Gerber even did in the recent glass and baby food issue. Where do you think Johnson & Johnson and Tylenol would be now? And what made the difference on their bottom line? You got it, public relations. How about change agentry? You know, organizations today, well, we used to say in this country, nothing is certain but death and taxes. Now we say nothing is certain but death, taxes, and change, because we know it's endemic. How does change come about? People in this country now accept change in a global fashion, but we're still threatened by it in individual situations. How do you bring change about? You bring it about by dealing with the relationships in which the change occurs. Public relationships, you know, what we do. We, therefore, can bring about smooth changes. And our organization's changing. The conference board says, based on several studies, that 95% of all products and services offered today will not be offered as soon as 1995. Do you hear that? 95% they predict. Now, we may be offering them packaged differently, technology may have advanced them to a new state, but all of that is going to take a lot of acceptance of change inside the organization and outside. Does that affect the bottom line? Well, it's a little thing known as survival, and we've got it. Then there's a final thing, identified by Philip Morris, as a matter of fact. It's called the double bottom line. George Weissman, whom some of you I hope know, started out as a public relations director for Philip Morris, longtime member of PRSA, became chairman of the company. When he was chairman, he became concerned. You know, when you make basically beer and cigarettes, you got a few things to worry about these days in our abstaining society. And so he said, I wonder if our social responsibility has any impact on our bottom line. A lot of talk about that, but everybody said, oh, it's soft. George set up some studies and found that indeed it is not soft, that the social responsibility of an organization pays off on its bottom line in a way that auditors can identify. All right, now take these eight methods by which we affect the bottom line. And I'll give you a little handout just so you don't forget what I said, if somebody would get these around for me. Take those eight methods. And don't take my word for it. Make up your own list. But ask yourself, is there any one of those that we can do without research? Is there any one that we can do without research? If there is, I don't know which one it is. This one is a form of research. 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 And the other four, it seems to me, if we're going to answer the variables, we jolly well are going to have lots of research. If you feel that you can make one of those contributions, anyone, to your bottom line without some kind of research, just shooting from the hip, then I would merely suggest that you take another look. Because it seems to me that the difference between being able to do these and not being able to do these has nothing to do with our technical skill. You can have the greatest technical skill in the world for change agentry. But if you don't know what the motivations, what the attitudes, what the behaviors, what the lifestyles and the values are of the public you want to change, it doesn't matter, does it? How great your message strategy skills, what a great personal persuader you are, how well you hold meetings and get everybody turned on. The key is no longer our technical skill. The key is knowing the variables and gearing what we do to deal with those real variables. Not how people ought to think, not how they ought to be behaving, but how, in human nature terms, they really are behaving. Second point, quickly. We know a lot now about what public relations really does en masse. And what it does is totally different than we thought before. It is so crucial to the basic functioning of every organization, as I hope to show you in a little model I want to share with you. Starting in 1900, when Freddie Taylor did the first management research with his famous time and motion studies for GE, which is why management research got such a bad name right from the start. Maybe that wasn't the thing to do first, you know, not awfully popular. Ever since then, we've had 50,000 theories on what makes an organization effective. Recently, a group took all of that theory that was still relevant in the modern world and put it together, and here's what they found. They found, first of all, that there is a model that fits every kind of organization, the corner drugstore with two people and General Motors, you know, with half of the population. Secondly, they found, and hear this carefully, because this is what they found, the product or service that you offer has almost nothing to do with the effectiveness of an organization today, and here's why. The public assumes that you're going to offer it well and at a quality value, because if you don't, they just won't accept it, and they put you out of business as fast as they can. And it's happening all around us. So that's sort of your ticket of admission, is having a product, well-designed, well-sold, customer satisfaction, quality, all of that stuff. That's just the ticket for admission. And think of how many organizations say, yeah, but we make the best forks in the world. Los Alamos National Labs is a client of ours. I spent a week there last week having the quarterly argument, why good science does not sell itself. But I'm the greatest quark physicist in the world, says this guy. Great. What's your name again? Short. I never heard of you. Nobody else ever heard of you. Most people can't even pronounce quark, to say anything about spelling it. Okay? Doesn't matter, does it? Unless he can communicate and persuade others, all of his vast knowledge of value to mankind is down the tubes. Okay. If you can start with that assumption, here's what makes effective organizations in our society. They begin, of course, with a mission. We all know that because we've been busy writing those mission statements. A mission is nothing more than a listing of values. What are the values of this organization? If we have a mission, and hopefully it's not 14 pages, it's a paragraph, or better yet, a sentence. Anybody here that has a less than 14-page mission statement, raise your hand. Well, good for the few of you. Now go home and get them down into, you know, when better cars are built, Buick will build them. That's what we're talking about. Or a list of five values or something like that. If we do this, we can position the organization. We can come up with a unique selling proposition. We can have goals, objectives, all those things. But how can you do any of those without this? Okay? If we get the values out there, then we can have a culture. And I know you're tired of corporate culture. So am I. It's not the point. It is absolutely essential. It is a truth, because what a corporate culture is shared values. People inside share the value system. What does this mean? Some interesting implications here. It means some people ought to be out of the organization if they cannot share the values. Either that or those people have to be empowered to participate and change the values. I've got a client right now that has three cultures going within it. The betting is whether they'll be bankrupt in 1 year or three, because you just can't function with that kind of balkanization of a company. We know a lot about corporate culture. You've all read the books. You know about heroes and role models. In case you're confused about that, I think we've now found that heroes are generally dead and role models are elderly. That seems to be the only way to attain those positions today. The main thing about a shared value system is it enables us to speak with one clear voice, and I don't think this audience needs me to tell them how critical that is. But it is critical. If we have shared values, then at last we're ready to go outside and build public relationships, because public relationships are nothing more than expressed values. Expressed values. And I certainly don't need to tell you how to bring about public relationships. If we do those three steps, a wonderful thing happens. It's kind of a perpetual motion machine. We start building a reputation, a positive reputation, because a reputation is nothing more than understood values. And this is why people hang with us when we're criticized, are willing to trust us, because they understand our values. And when they don't hang with us, it's because they don't know what our values are. It's dog sniffing all over again. Two dogs sniff each other because they don't know if the other one is going to bite. People are no different. We need to know what people's values are. Now I ask you, think of your organization and tell me whether you presently have all the information you need on all the variables that will enable you to convince the management there and then to carry out a program that will build you into that system. If you can answer yes, wonderful. Then I want to know why you don't have the greatest reputation in America. It can be done. There's the system. Now, notice, we're talking about effective organizations. Look at those four steps. And tell me how many of them involve accountants, and how many of them involve the lawyers, and how many of them even involve other aspects of the company. All those people are down at the threshold level for just winning enough public consent in the marketplace, or the marketplace of ideas, just to exist. If you want to be an excellent organization, the difference is what you and I call public relationships right here. The problem is that we, I think, have had a difficult time getting this across to our managements. And the reason is because our standard response has been, well, I think, and managers don't care what we think. Managers want to know what is the evidence. The key words today in every field, but especially in public relations. What's the evidence? And more importantly, what's the behavioral evidence that that is true? We have research techniques today to find it out. If we find it out, our organizations can become like that. But they won't become like that without us or someone else with our public relations skills being very close to the top. Don't take my word for it. Just go read some of those wonderful, quote, management, unquote, books again and ask yourself how close they are to this model. Most of them are right on target. They're talking about us and what we do. I think this should be so tremendously empowering to us that I want to do all the research I can do for every client so I can get in there at the decision table and persuade and persuade and persuade that this is the way to go, because it's in everybody's enlightened self-interest to do so. The organization benefits, the management benefits, the line employees benefit, and the public benefits. And if that all happens, our society benefits. We can be the most phenomenal change agents in the history of the world if we will only accept the challenge. And the basis of that challenge, in my opinion, is equating public relations with human nature, with understanding that people don't care that much about the facts. They care about perceptions. with understanding that top-down kind of dictatorial operations don't work. Participation works. With understanding that indeed we need to find out the needs and values of our publics and then incorporate them in our decision-making process. In short, we need to concentrate on various research techniques, formal and informal, qualitative and quantitative, to give us the managerial tools to make every organization like this. What a wonderful world it would be if when you called up the electric utility, they were a responsive organization, and they cared about their expressed values and their relationship, and they said, yes, sir, we'll fix it right away. And do you need more information? And can I help you do this? Wouldn't that be wonderful? And when you walked into the store, the retail clerks were trained, and they gave you a little time to walk around and didn't jump on you like a duck on a June bug the minute you came through the door and said, can I help you, sir? What can I sell you? I think it would. And I think we can make it happen. Let me just leave you with a definition of human nature, because I think sometimes it's misunderstood what I mean by human nature. I was giving a speech at a school in New Jersey, Glassboro State University, which has one of the excellent public relations sequences in the United States. It was a luncheon affair, and I went into the men's room to wash my hands before lunch. And in this men's room, instead of good old all-American paper towels, they had one of those communistic machines that blows hot air at you, you know the kind? On this machine is an instruction plate, and this instruction plate is just what I mean by the definition of human nature. Instructions were, 1, shake excess water from hands, 2, push button to operate machine, and 3, wipe hands lightly under warm airflow until dry. Well, that's logical, factual, anti-human information. Somebody who understood human nature had been there before me on the definition of human nature. 4, wipe hands on pants. If we can learn how to do that, and research is what shows us how to do it, I am here in a room full of change agents for the rest of this century and the 21st century. I urge you to join the team, to get out of the news release only syndrome, the communication only syndrome, and take grasp of these wonderful tools, and let's change this world. I want it better, don't you? Let's make it better. Thanks for listening. Thank you.